Good morning.
Good morning. Call to order the meeting of the Safety and Security Committee. We have an agenda for today's session, which I'll comment on when we start, but are there any other issues that we should be raising with respect to the agenda? Hearing none, we'll move ahead. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of our December meeting?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. This month's agenda, we thought at one point would be a follow-up with the talk, but we've rescheduled that to next month. Matt is here to listen. We're going to cover three items. One is an update on where we are with respect to NTSB recommendations, recognizing that when the NTSB has come in, it's been a very serious incident, and we really need to give considerable weight to resolving their issues. And we'll hear about where we are in more detail than just the numbers, sort of what are they. We'll get a report on some recent incidents, and then briefly comment on where the state of play is on rulemakings for fatigue in a number of different transportation modes. But before we do that, let me call on Jim for our safety advisory.
Thank you, Chairman Downey. On our safety contact this morning, we'd like to just mention safety belts, as we are all required to wear safety belts when driving a motor vehicle. And ask that in this winter weather with bulky clothes that you pay particular attention to make sure that the lap belt is down over your hips and that the shoulder harness is properly across your shoulders down to where it meets at your waist. Sometimes they kind of get bunched up. Some folks don't the shoulder harness in front of them. They like to put it behind them because they don't like rubbing on their neck. But many cars have an adjustment to raise and lower the shoulder harness so that it can be more comfortable when wearing. So just like to focus on that. This is also a season that we have icy conditions, as we've had earlier. So certainly would like to keep everyone safe and also remind you to exercise caution. We sometimes don't know if we're on a wet road or an icy road. And as far as if the fire alarm would go off in the building, the strobe lights would go off, there would be a rather loud, audible signal. We would ask that you exit through one of the doors with the exit sign or in the main entrance where you came in, out the front doors of the Jackson Graham building, and assemble in front of the building museum across the street, and at which time we would try and ensure that we have everybody accounted for. That would conclude the safety contact.
Thank you, and I particularly appreciate the comment about safety belts. I was at a session yesterday at Transportation Research Board with the current secretary and five former secretaries, including Alan Boyd at age 93, the first Secretary of Transportation. And as they talked about things they had done, one of Alan's comments was, "We put seat belts in cars." And the auto industry said nobody would ever buy a car with seat belts in it. It'll cost too much and it won't make a difference. That and a couple of other things that have happened would have brought our rate of highway fatalities down from 55,000 a year to under 35,000. And that's the kind of progress we have to make, and it's kind of reason we do the safety work in this agency in the mode. You can make improvement. But Alan took credit for getting it started. Okay. NTSB.
Okay. Good morning, Chairman Downey and members of the board. It is, again, my pleasure to be able to address the board Safety and Security Committee, in which, as Mr. Downey has stated, we will further in the report discuss the status of the NTSB recommendations. We're continuing to strive proactively to improving the safety culture, I'd like to note that, throughout Metro today, and there are a number of information items that we'd also like to discuss with you. And first, I'd like to start off with our key performance indicators. And there's been a little bit of, news around this, and I hope that after my report that's clarified. Our first key performance indicator is the employee injury rate per 200,000 miles. This rate is for our OSHA, or Occupational Safety and Health Administration, recordable injuries. In November, we had 41 injuries for a rate of 4.98 injuries per 100 employees working a normal year, while October, we had 54 injuries for a rate of 5.46. and that's a 9% rate decrease from the month of November 2011 to the month of October 2011. Strains continue to be our number one cause, followed by slips, trips, and falls, and striking or struck by. And we, realizing that, are offering a class to our employees on what we're calling body mechanics and proper lifting, and so that they hopefully can avoid those kind of injuries. Now I'd like to talk about how we finished up in 2011. That would be our year-to-date figures. This actual graphic goes through November, but we've been able to put together the December statistics since the board package went out. In December, we had 38 employee injuries for a rate of 3.56. That's, again, 3.56 injuries per 200,000 hours worked. That gave us a year-end rate of 5.19 injuries per 200,000 hours worked, which is 6.5% under our 2011 target of 5.55. We're always striving for zero, but we want to set our targets. It's also 11% lower than our 2010 year-end rate of 5.86. This is an outstanding achievement, and we believe is one that's recognizable. We were below our target of 5.55 for the last 4 months of 2011. Even with the positive trend, we're seeing safety is still trying to proactively decrease the amount of injuries our employees are having, because our goal, as I've mentioned, is always zero. Safety blitzes are continuing to occur at targeted areas which have a high occurrence of employee injuries. These blitzes, as we call them, include safety personnel being deployed to conduct impromptu training and outreach, including training on back safety and lifting techniques in an effort to reduce the strains. We move on to our customer injury rate, which also I definitely want to point out is down year to date, contrary to maybe a report you may have heard somewhere else. This is our second KPI for customer injuries per million passenger trips. This includes all customers, whether bus, metro access, or rail, including passengers on board, in our transit facilities, and using our escalators and elevators. For the month of November, we had 58 customer injuries for a rate of 2.08 injuries per million trips. October's numbers, we had 43 customer injuries for a rate of 1.46 injuries. That is where you see for that month there was a 35% increase. That is only the month of November comparison to the month of October comparison. Our customer injury rate increased for November mainly due to an increase in the bus passenger injuries. We had 10 bus collisions in November that resulted in 20 of our customers being transported away from the scene for medical attention. And that's if they claimed injury, and then they would be examined in a hospital. Now I'd like to mention how we finished up for 2011, and this is the entire calendar year. We had 64 customer injuries in December for a rate of, and I'm sorry, that's the December month, for a rate of 2.37 injuries per million trips. The December increase was partly due to the rise in, again, the bus passenger injuries. We had 7 collisions in which 24 customers were transported from the scene. One would be one of the incidents that we'll talk about a little later in the presentation on December 28th. Overall for the year, we ended up with a total rate of 1.87 customer injuries per million trips. That is 6% below our target of 1.99. It is also 10.5% lower than our 2010 year-end rate of 2.09. And this, again, we feel is an outstanding achievement. We're going to continue aiming for the zero number. We have a lot of programs in place, and we're going to continue to focus to drive down these rates. But even with the reduction in the frequency of customer injuries, we're continuing to look for ways to eliminate hazards. We'll talk about hazards a little bit later in the report that can potentially cause an injury. Safety continues to perform rail station inspections on a regular basis. Facility issues are reported to the Maintenance Operations Center and followed up with to ensure safety concerns are being addressed. And if there are ones that come to the safety hotline, we're following up on those also, or that come in through another office and get reported to safety. A safety communications campaign is underway in attempts to enhance safety and enhance our safety culture to involve our customers from the bottom up through a basic focus on routine injury prevention using various communication channels in an attempt to modify risky customer behavior that may lead to injuries. And at another meeting, you will see some of the things that folks do that we wonder why, that there's an opportunity to injure themselves. So we're going to continue to work on that, educate our customers, such things. Don't stand near the edge of the platforms. Don't plank on our escalators. If you don't know what that's, spinning between the handrails of the escalators. And people do, and we have that on video. So it's kind of some of the things that you wonder why adults do that we're going to try and help them to understand that they shouldn't. Moving on to our correction. Yes, sir, thank you. And we will. Okay, this is our updated bar graph reflecting the open corrective action plans. And what I'd like to point out, there's only 13 remaining out of the 256. That 256 comes from the period of 2004 at the bottom of the graph in the left-hand corner up to the 2010. And these were ones that these were aging. You know, the board had asked that we look at these, we work on these. We have this number down to 13. So that's certainly another major accomplishment. What you see in the top line, basically there were 317 corrective action plans added during calendar year 2010. That of those, from June to December, there were corrective actions noted that were carrying in 10, but they really weren't added until 2011. So that's why that number seems higher. And that's also when the TOC had done a triennial audit. Every 3 years, the Tri-State Oversight Committee conducts a triennial audit and looks at things. And those got added in this category, as well as our own internal safety audits that's on our next page. So we became much more aggressive in our own internal auditing to identify any conditions that we need to actually take action to improve upon. And just certainly, you know, to note, move on to that slide. And, you know, from the previous month, and this is what I just mentioned, the 317 new caps, and this is the new caps and a breakdown of where they've come from, whether internal or external. And you will notice even now, the majority of the caps are coming from our internal auditing ourselves. This one represents in the 2010 triennial, there were 126 corrective action plans. Of those 127, 36 were noted as deficiencies, 91 were areas of concern. So that would, you know, those are the ones that's just something that we'd look at that has a concern, but certainly not listed as a deficiency. For the 17 from the NTSB at Fort Totten, two of those 17 went to all transit properties across the country. 15 were related to Fort Totten. Our own internal safety audits, we added 106 corrective actions. From the Inspector General, 19 that were safety related. From VTX, who looked at our escalators and elevators, 5, and from investigations, from incidents, 43. So provide you a bit of some of the work that's been done. This chart shows you the hazard resolution matrix. As we talked about at a prior meeting, our hazard resolution process, we follow what's known as the Military Standard 882. So there is an actual standard on whether something is likely to occur, may occur, remote, things along that line. We have three corrective actions that are currently listed in the unacceptable category as determined by us, by WMATA. Those three, the first one represented was from the Fort Totten accident, which is rated in the 1B category in the red. That recommendation is to conduct a comprehensive safety analysis of the Metrorail automatic train control system to evaluate all foreseeable failures of this system that could result in a loss of train separation and work with train control equipment manufacturers to address in that analysis all potential failure modes that could cause a loss of train detection, including parasitic oscillation, cable faults and placement, and corrugated rail. Working with rail operations, they've currently set a target date of closure and completion of this of December 2012. And these that I mentioned, Dave Kubicek will provide further detail on the status and the progress where we're at a little later in the report. But I wanted, yes, sir.
With respect to that one, it is of critical importance, and we'll talk about it as we move into NTSB. But I would suggest all of us get educated on that. We can't deal with the technical side of a signal system, but I think we are the ones to assure the public that we've done everything we should have done to have a system that has integrity and will work. I feel that's a policy obligation that we have, and when that study is complete, we should really pay a lot of attention to what's in it. It could have consequences that say we're going to have to invest a lot of money to upgrade the system, or it could say, looking at what we have with the fixes that are in, this has 5/9 of reliability, and that's about as good as you can get. But to me, that's a policy call that we're going to have to do. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
Including a decision ultimately about the unknowns about the train control system. Train control systems of this age have a lot of software anomalies that we found on the Northeast Corridor train control system that led to the decision to totally replace the entire train control system because we couldn't actually iron out the uncertainties. And the only viable solution was a new train control system that was fully documented, that all of the operators were fully trained on. And it was very expensive, but it was a necessity about ironing out the uncertainties in the system, as Chair Downey was mentioning.
Thank you. Good. We'll see if there are any other questions before we go on to the NTSB side, but I wanted to really flag that one.
Thank you. Appreciate that. The second recommendation that's in the unacceptable category of the red is the one that is in the 1C category, and that also is Fort Totten, and that is based on the findings of the safety analysis recommended in R10-12, and that's the NTSB recommendation number, incorporate the design, operational, and maintenance controls necessary to address potential failures in the automatic train control system. We can't set the target date, you know, for completion of this until the analysis is complete to determine what would actually need to be done, as Mr. Downey and Mr. Downs noted there. We have to know what we need to do to be able to put together the plan to do it. And the third condition, or the third hazard noted, is a 2B, and that is from the VTX report, to modify escalator machine room entrances where possible to eliminate ship's ladder access. And an example would be at DuPont South, and that's for those that are familiar. Ship ladders go straight vertical up the wall and can certainly result in some challenges. But, you know, the other caps that are listed in here, we have 94 that are in the undesirable category. And an example of an undesirable corrective action, and rather than read to you all of them that we have, I figured we'd touch on an example in each of the categories. Is we have an NTSB recommendation, number 10-20, and that's to remove all 1,000 series rail cars as soon as possible and replace them with cars that have crash-worthiness collision protection, at least comparable to the 6,000 series cars. We are in the process of doing that, but as the board knows, that's a little ways out here in the future. That one actually, you know, that particular cap would be in an undesirable condition. 19 caps that are acceptable with review of the Executive Safety Committee. And just as a reminder, the Executive Safety Committee meets every month, just met this past Tuesday, includes many members of the ELT and key operational staff. So issues that are brought up from a local safety committee or a departmental safety committee that either needs action of the Executive Safety Committee, a review of a hazard, or for information of the Executive Safety Committee comes up at those meetings. And actually, all 12 meetings were held last year, you know, so there is that opportunity, you know, where we look at that. And an example of an acceptable with review by the Executive Safety Committee cap, it was from the TOC Triennial Review Finding 10-198 that states Power does not have a suitable departmental maintenance plan or similar document to guide inspection and maintenance practices throughout the Metro Rail process. And they're working on that. But basically, you can see that's a document-based, you know, corrective action that we would be working on. There are 49 caps, as you note, that are acceptable without any kind of an extensive review. And although these caps could potentially cause a hazardous condition, and that's it's a potential, the frequency and probability of occurrence are very minimal. An example of an acceptable without review cap is one of the internal safety audit findings that states no SOPs are available to cover vandalism and graffiti remediation of power substations.
When we say it's acceptable, it doesn't mean it's acceptable to leave it undone. What we're saying is it can be resolved without having to look above the level of the person who resolves it.
Correct. It needs done ultimately, but we do have some time, and we're trying to prioritize because to take all the corrective actions, we want to focus on the ones that that are the greatest hazard and also provide the greatest degree of protection.
Okay. Do you have a question on this part?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. We haven't heard much about it in some time, but item number 13 on the NTSB report was the development of a real-time loss of shunt detection system. I know Mr. Kubitschek was really hot on that and had some early reports on it, but where does that one fit into this matrix, and what is the latest status of it?
Let's see where they are. And Mr. Kubitschek is going to provide the status of that.
Yeah, as we
follow, you know, a little bit later here in the report. That is one of the items
we haven't gotten there yet.
That he will. And the loss of shunt.
Mr. Giancola, as we get through the report and stuff, I'll definitely give you all an update on that one right there, and we'll check to see where the rating and stuff is at.
Okay. Anything else on the overhead part, and then we'll talk about the specific NTSB items. Okay.
I apologize. I don't know the rating off the top of my head. All of them are important to me, so.
Yes.
And I have it in the report, but of the three, I hate to give you the wrong rating, but I will look it up when Mr. Kubitschek's speaking here shortly, if that's acceptable. If I could provide some background, we'll move to the, the NTSB recommendations specifically. And getting into the background on the NTSB recommendations, over the lifetime of WMATA, there have been specific recommendations made to WMATA or more general recommendations that go out to all transit properties to the U.S., and that's one of the things that the NTSB will do. They actually had done that for the fatigue, and to look at that. They put to all transit agencies that all transit agencies should look at their fatigue program, their medical questionnaires, to try and determine or evaluate if someone is subject to or has a sleep disorder. Currently, as you'll see, we have 27 open and acceptable recommendations to WMATA, with 59% of those, or 16, that we are awaiting consideration for closure from the NTSB, and all the rest are being actively worked on toward final disposition. We had submitted 14 packets, if you will, requesting closure from the NTSB, 14 back in June 2010. We just submitted another two in December or early January for consideration. We do provide update reports, but through the individual I understand that works on those has had a backlog, so our request has been backburned for about 4 months, and I'm assured they're going to get to looking at those. But we cannot officially close them out until the NTSB closes it out, and then the Tri-State Oversight Committee also will close them out on their report upon the recommendation.
And I did have a conversation with the chair of the NTSB yesterday and urged that they give us their advice as quickly as they can.
Great. I think we'd appreciate that because we'd certainly love to close them. As discussed at previous meetings and just previously mentioned, all hazards are processed through the hazard analysis process and classified, including the NTSB ones, by severity and frequency in accordance, as I've mentioned, with the military standard 882. And if you remember from the color-coded matrix that was displayed with the red, yellow, blue, and white, just the previous slide, two of these NTSB recommendations are classified by WMATA as unacceptable Category 1. Also, I'd like to note that this report doesn't include one NTSB recommendation to the board, as the NTSB has already closed it. The board acted quickly on the NTSB recommendation from Fort Totten, so that recommendation is closed, and We, as I'm sure they, the NTSB does, thank the board.
Mr.
So that
Chairman.
Was closed and acceptable, so we're not actually carrying that on the list that you will see. Today's briefing basically will only address those recommendations that we're still working on or in progress. And the matrix of all 27 recommendations and their status is actually in your appendix.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question, and as the newest member, I apologize if, but I just need a little background. What's the normal time period that it takes for NTSB to get back when you request that something be closed like that? Because I'm trying to figure out if there's been a delay.
It depends.
Truly, it's anywhere from a few months to, I probably shouldn't say, but a year or so. Typically, their accident reports are normally 1 year in arrears. Just, you know, when they generate an accident report, and then they have their recommendations as a part of that accident report. But I would say typically, in my past experience, at least 6 months, but a lot of times closer to a year.
Okay, and because I was just curious, I mean, given the high visibility of Fort Totten, whatever, the sooner we could get something back from them, and I don't know if maybe a request from you, maybe that's what you did when you
that's
talked to the chair.
In a yeah.
kinder, gentler way, just to let us know if we need to step it up a little bit.
And although I think they got, but probably one of the closest was to close the recommendation of the board. It only took them about a couple months.
Right. So those of you who were here at the time, what the board was asked to do was create a safety committee, put safety back into the mission statement, and generally get the visibility of safety much higher. We did that very quickly and got a turnaround very quickly from the safety board that said that's the right thing to do. Yes.
Just page 10, you talked about the 10 bus collisions. How many of those were preventable? Have we completed our investigation of those 10 bus crashes and collisions?
It's from the safety department, for the ones that we're investigating, we have not completed the investigations of those 10. We generate basically a report based on the facts and then meet with the operations group. And I don't have the exact figure right now for you for the determination of preventability, but we can get that for you from the determination, which is made by the superintendent, of whether or not an accident is preventable or non-preventable. But going back to the NTSB recommendations, you'll see here the breakdown, the 15 are related to Fort Totten, 12 predate the Fort Totten incident, 16, as I've mentioned, already submitted, and pretty much covered most of the information on this particular slide. So we'll move to the next slide, and this is, as we go through this presentation, starting with those presentations, we'll start with them prior to the Fort Totten incident, and at this point I'd like to ask Mr. Kubitschek to discuss the status.
Good morning.
Morning.
Where we're at on the equipment, all of the rolling stock, we only like one series of fleet to be completed across the board. The last fleet is the 5,000 series that needs to be completed. We've awarded the contract. We've got the design and stuff. Everything is approved, and we're forecasting to have that done by September of 2012, and then that will close that one out. We'll see. It's really just a software issue, you know, at this stage, so it takes a lot of little extra time on those things there, but we're in good shape to complete that. But everything else that we have that's running has rollback protection now.
Yeah, and that's the safety issue is a train that's parked could actually roll back if it's on a grade and hit a train behind it, which is what happened in Woodley.
Mr. Downey?
Yes.
Mr. Kubitschek, that was my question, is where are we along in this particular process? And I would just note that the reports that you guys give us for the board are really wonderful. This one didn't have an update underneath of it in the way that some of the other items did. So, you know, if you look at the next one where it says we're at 88% or whatever, in the future I would just suggest we make sure we include the status, because it looks like, I know there was a lot done, but I had no way quickly to understand that.
And also,
note that this one, as with the others, the NTSB grades as open with an acceptable response.
Right.
So
right.
They believe we're doing the right thing at the right speed.
Right.
But
the
if
more
we don't,
we can,
we'll hear from them.
Yeah, and the more we can kind of gather that info for ourselves on these pages, the better the communication is to the public and gives us better talking points to go back to as board members.
Sure.
Too.
Sure.
Okay. With the guarded number 8 turnouts, we're scheduled to complete all of that by June of 2012. We do have a lot of outages and such that are going to be taking place, you know, this year. So as you see those things, June of 2012, we should have this one completed. We were on schedule, and we've commented before that this one has been around for quite some time. We met with the NTSB a couple of years ago, and we, to date, have hit that schedule 100%. That was the first time in the history for this organization. So there was a lot of good work that's taken place on that there. The other recommendation in regards to develop new technology for automatic alert of workers and such, that's a very complex, very subjective process. We've worked with a number of vendors about, you know, utilizing equipment that mounts on an employee, utilizing equipment that you put inside of a rail car that shuts it down, looking at FRA applications. What we have at this stage, we have a test pilot that we install between Gallery Place and Judiciary Square, and it's a lighting system that basically interlocks. Whenever a worker is down, it puts an additional light that is specially to alert an operator that there is workers that are ahead. It's built into our infrastructure, and it's very, very robust. We've done our reviews, our analysis, and that is the product in which we're moving forward with. We don't have a final cost of this because it wasn't really included into the capital project 100%. The red line segment contract and the orange-blue line segment contract, we've started initiating some modifications. So as we're out there adjusting the infrastructure side, we will start installing this. This will be a multi-year project. It does not happen overnight. But our gap measure that we've had since then is the new roadway worker protection guidebook and the new training and the new procedures and stuff that we have out there. We also approached it from a standpoint that this system is special and unique for WMATA because everybody's railroad environments and such are a little bit different, you know, different headways and everything else. So line of sight, blind curves, those type of things, going over hills and everything else, it is a custom fit for us. But at this stage, that's where our energy and focus is going, and we'll be in the process. We've communicated with and safety naturally, and everybody else has been, you know, part of the process, and this is the direction in which we're going. And I don't have, like I said, an exact date at this time because we've been working on this one. The reason why we stayed away from the employee-mounted devices is if you were wearing, like, a heavy jacket and something was trying to vibrate, or if you're working out in the highway, employees really can't hear it. And the other thing is we don't want to displace good, solid rules. And we don't want to give people a false sense of security whenever they're out there. We need to be nervous and alert all the time when we're working on that railroad, when we have live track.
Safety Board, as I recall, has not issued a report yet on the other employee fatalities. Are they still investigating? Or
they've completed their investigation from what we're told, just as they've had their backlog. And I know that the San Bruno incident in California consumed a lot of their resources.
Yeah.
We've been expecting the report on and off. Has had different dates that they expect to release it, but they're going to release, as we understand it, and expect all three of the outstanding reports at one time.
Thank you.
So, for our reports. And to answer Mr. Giancola's question, the loss of shunt tool was rated a 1D, and the basic reason for that, when you ask, is because it's a not, you know, loss of shunt tool is a non-vital system. It's a warning system, but it does not control the direct train movements. So being a non-vital, it was classified as a 1D. We can.
Yes.
As a relatively new board member, in the budget for this year, we've got loss of shunt tools, okay? What is this? It's like millions of dollars in this current budget, and now we're seeing it on the safety side. What? How do you lose shunt tools, or is this just a phrase that I don't understand?
Okay. Yeah. If I could, that's a great segue, because that's the next topic on our presentation.
For those of you who need remedial loss of shunt, because you were here at the time, it always worked, but a lot of us need that. I wasn't here, but I was here to hear about it after the fact.
All right. What I'll try to do here is I'll give a brief description of what it's supposed to do in interest of time.
And then if there is a more detailed explanation, I'm more than happy to provide that. But in short, what this loss of shunt is, the basic underline of our railroad is controlled by the automatic train control system, the actual signaling system. That is a basic. It is a vital system, which it recognizes all movement, and it's supposed to stop trains, you know, allow, you know, fleet. It is our, the baseline. The loss of shunt is basically another layer of protection which is being developed. It thinks separate and upon differently than what your automatic train control system does. Basically, what it's supposed to do is monitor what the actual train control system is thinking and applying. When we use the reference non-vital and vital, the automatic train control system is vital, meaning that it basically, if it sees an anomaly or if it sees like there's trains and stuff are too close, it actually issues the command to shut down the vehicle, okay, to the point of even bring it to a complete stop. That's even separate and above if we had a person that was in there with the master controller and stuff that was moving. It knocks them down to a stop or slows them down. The non-vital application, what it does is basically it's monitoring everything, and it doesn't have the power or the authority to issue that command, but what we have done and what we've developed is that if we see an anomaly, we have enabled an alert system that goes into the train control, into our operational control center, and what happens is that we'll put information up onto the screens. We've got like a light, an alarm, and so there's some human interaction that takes place to say, uh-oh, we have got an anomaly that's taken place that the automatic train control system possibly did not detect. And this is our solution at this time, you know, going forward. It's a very complex process. So that's my basic basic explanation. Now,
if I could follow up on that.
Okay.
Loss of shunt is kind of a euphemism for we got a train out there that we can't see.
Yes.
It's in a block of the system. It should be protected in that block. The system has not detected it.
Yeah.
And this is a concern whether we're in automatic mode or manual mode.
Yes, sir.
If we don't know there's a train there, the information doesn't get to either the system or the operator to say slow down or stop. So it's like your EKG showing that you've heart has stopped beating. It's a bad sign. Bad sign.
Mr. Downey, can I ask another question?
Yes.
So
yes.
We didn't have a loss of shunt system in a detection system in place when the accident occurred.
If Safety I could board clarify. Report suggested we did have one, but was issuing so many alarms it had been turned off.
Ah, okay.
There was a tool and stuff that was present, and it was a manual process. There was some issues with the control center as well as a number of alarms, but it was also its application. The loss of shunt tool that we have developed and that is working right now is 100% automated. It's thinking all the time, and it's looking at all of the rail lines simultaneously, all train movement. It does not require an individual to monitor it per se to make sure that it's actually working and stuff. It is fully automated thinking, just like the automatic train control system.
So this system has been developed, tested, and you're telling me it is actually in use today?
It is in use. We have done, shifting gears, we have done a formal presentation to the NTSB. They have been into the control center along with safety, and there was, you know, multiple representatives that have been there. And we are actually, our feedback from the NTSB was extremely positive, and we are in the process of pulling all of the material now to issue that to safety department so that way they can communicate that to the NTSB to see if this is an acceptable closure of the cap. I will also bring forward that during this journey, because, you know, there's not really a lot of loss of shunt automated train detection systems that are out there. They're either like a vital overlay with a vital system that has double redundancy. This right in here has really created a very interesting forum for us because as we're looking at surface finishes of rail. It's really taken us into a level or journey where we've found out more about this rail system, and some of the past practices have been done for the last 30 or 40 years, it's really caused us to look at things a little bit different, not only just here at WMATA, but probably, you know, throughout the industry. And there's a lot of interest on their part of agencies wanting to come to talk to us to look at it and everything else. And we're very hesitant to say, and very sincere to say, we cannot guarantee that this is what you should do on your system, but we will share everything that we have as part of our journey to ensure that, you know, that you have as much protection and stuff that you have. So it's so whenever the presentation stuff was conducted, we actually went, it just wasn't about the loss of shunt. It was about how it impacted our maintenance practices, our design practices, and stuff of what we're looking at. It was also the interfacing when an alarm takes place, because it's just not about going off into the control center. Our engineers get a real-time BlackBerry, you know, email. It's layers of departments and stuff. And, for example, whenever this thing, if we do have a detection that takes place, it actually populates and it tells the controller exactly the location, the rail car, everything else. It's very specific detail because we're dealing with seconds here, and we want to be able to make sure that everything is as clear and as concise as possible.
So the safety board closing this will not be, now we can use it. It will be they are expressing comfort that this is an answer, and might well then say around the industry, you all ought to be doing something like this.
Well,
it just goes to the next level is, okay, so from our customer point of view, and also from the operating in the system point of view, when would you expect at some point in the future we would go back to automatic controls rather than manual?
Yeah. If there's,
I mean, I think that's the kind of thing.
The answer to that is when we are satisfied after all the safety analysis is done that we have a system that is safer to operate an automatic train operation and manual train operation. I've deliberately not set a date for that or forecasted it because I do not want the pressure of a date to force decisions that should not be made quickly. I want this to be very deliberate. We're going to go through this, and we come to that conclusion after all the analysis, then we'll announce when we can go to automatic train operation.
And after all the replacement of potentially faulty equipment.
And more specific answer to Ms. Hines's question, how many alerts per day was the system receiving that caused them to shut the system off or to simply ignore it? How many on average?
There were thousands of alerts that were being generated.
That's the answer. We had a system. We didn't know how to manage it. We had no quality control over it, and it was probably an obsolete technology. So,
Greg, one other thing.
Turn your mic on.
Thank you.
I will just say, for my colleague's benefit, I did listen in on the, you know, the web streaming 2 weeks ago. And it was extremely frustrating when I could hear their answers to questions that I had no idea. So I'm going to be a little merciless about hitting your mic because it really was confusing as a listener out there. So everybody should make a real effort.
Thank you. In terms of safety, I would recommend to the chairman and to the board that because we have so many new members, and this is a pretty technical area, that the general manager set up for the board a session at the control center and at a rail yard about rail maintenance. I think it's really important for everybody. We tend to slip into a lot of jargon, and sometimes I see a lot of blank looks about what we're talking about, and I think it's worth the time and effort of the board to spend a couple of hours at the control center going through all of the issues of the current challenges and the management of what the system can and can't do. And the same thing with the challenges that Mr. Kubitschek talked about the rail maintenance, the maintenance of the equipment itself, and how that is staged and how it works. So I encourage that to happen soon.
Whether as a group or individually.
Right.
Mr. Downey, if I could, I went out to the bus operations center last summer and, you know, had a chance to drive a bus simulator, but also to see the new operations center and talk with people about how that works. And it was time really well spent. And so I think as we think about our orientation process, that we really should do, we should insert some opportunities to see key facilities. So, you know, maybe we can, governance committee can maybe follow up on that and see if we can't set some field trips up. And if people can make them, great. And if you can't, you know, we'll figure out how to deal with that.
Okay. Other NTSB Fort Totten items?
Part of this is also one of the recommendations was remove unnecessary communication systems. The way that the system and such was originally designed is that they would go into an area of the rail system and they had multiple connection points. What we're doing is we're basically truly isolating the train control system towards it is its own controlled separate loop, so that way there's not any potential of an external source or signal or whatever that could be generated. In here we've done probably over 50% of the red line. We've done that remediation already. That's part of our train control module replacement and stuff as well. As we're going in there, we're packaging this work, and we've already started on the orange line as well. And so that's a specific recommendation that this will require us to go through every line 100% and do this execution. But we're making good progress on that, on the plan. Next page, remove of the 1,000 series rail cars. That is, we expect the first set of 8 cars here probably in the winter of 2013. We did have a 5-month slip, you know, due to the tsunami and the earthquake and everything else. We're in good shape, and the design and everything else is coming along very nicely. We're looking forward to that. This was discussed a little bit earlier about the safety analysis. A little bit more detail. We've staged this out into 4 phases, and the next phase that we wrap up here is going to be completed in April of 2012. I also want to reassure you all that if we found something along the way, which we have not waited, okay? There's been activities that we have been conducting and stacking on this. As we go through the study, if we find something, we do not wait to, this will be something good for us to do in the future whenever we get the report and stuff filed up. So there has been other things that have been conducted on this train control system that the NTSB was not aware of or wasn't, you know, part of the review, which we've made them aware of, as well as, you know, working with safety and everybody else. So I just wanted to reassure you all that we are not waiting. You know, we it's here to act on these things here.
I thought I heard a couple of minutes ago, December 2012, which is the date?
It will, on this one here, it will be December 2012. We're going to phase 3, then we go to phase 4, and for us, in December 2012, what we're going to have is the report complete with any other recommendations. And if we had any recommendations that we've already been working on, those would be noted as well. But that's where we will tie everything up when we view it.
So that could come to us as a package to say,
yes.
Are you comfortable
yes.
or not comfortable with the signal system? No.
And the recommendations will also include proposals for other capital items in order to improve the system.
Yes.
So that would also be on the agenda.
Okay. That it will.
Yes, it will.
Interesting okay. magnitude of it.
This one, number 5, was kind of discussed as well. Once we get the report and stuff, and then we issue it, you know, then we can start developing, you know, specific timelines and stuff after the fact. So that's really a parallel effort. The event recorders, the 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, and 6,000 series rail cars already have those. We are committed to install those on the 1,000 series, even though that we are retiring. It's a recommendation, and we need to, you know, for that data and the 4,000.
Even though they're never a lead car.
Yes, sir. Yeah. But if it's a lead cab. So we have awarded the contract on that, and we expect to have every rail car equipped here in the agency by December of 2013. Okay? As far as the maintenance of that, we've already got the maintenance program and stuff that's developed for all the existing rail car fleets. It's written into our preventative maintenance stuff, but we really can't close it out until we get all of the other rail cars and stuff equipped.
Any questions on those Fort Totten recommendations? As I said, I definitely urge everyone to pay attention on this safety, on the signal system issue in terms of the policy and our comfort level that we are protecting our customers to a very high degree of safety. It may be that at the end of 2012, we conclude that the system with such modifications that have happened is doing its job. But I don't think we should just assume because it's there, it's doing its job.
Yeah, we're definitely with this phase, next phase of the reports. Now we're getting into very detailed specifics. You know, your generalization, you're collecting stuff. So this is a very critical time.
Yes, we thank, you know, the NTSB for all their assistance. They've provided a lot of guidance with us. They work with us, and we sincerely do appreciate.
I mean, they have technical capability that others don't have. We may or may not have. The vendors may have, but you don't necessarily want to take their word for it. Somebody's got to be the underwriter's laboratory standard of, is this in fact state of the art?
Correct. And even things that they're not investigating, for instance, they work with us also, offer their assistance. We appreciate that. Moving on, if we could, to the FTA state safety oversight audit that was conducted in December 2009. We're certainly very pleased to note that on January 11, 2012, that the FTA formally closed the last of the open recommendations from their audit of WMATA and the TOC. So WMATA had received 10 recommendations, TOC had received 5, and the FTA has determined that we have accomplished everything that they asked for, and, you know, actually noted, and, you know, the strong, the strength and safety effort that's been made. So we certainly appreciate that. As you see,
what's in yellow is a quote from FTA, correct?
Correct. Yeah. And I believe we've provided that report to everyone. But
and just as we talked about with the numbers, that's great that we've now been blessed with their positive response, but it doesn't mean we relax and stop doing anything.
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. And we still meet with them. As you know, there's the regular quarterly meetings. We have meetings with the FTA safety office, and it's a pretty close working relationship. So appreciate their support and help and guidance also. If I could, we'll move into some of the recent incidents that have occurred, and would like to ask Mr. Kubicek to start off with the December 2nd, 2011 event with the 10-car train.
Okay. The explanation is just pretty straightforward. Realistically, on an item like this, it was caused by human error. I mean, there is an employee, an operator that's supposed to be conducting the walk around before they dispatch the rail car. We've got a tower supervisor that's looking at the overall yard. And then as the train makes its way from the storage track through the yard, through staging for the main line, we call it an interlocking. And basically, that's at the end of the platform. Those layers of individuals are there to prevent it. We're not looking at technology. This is a basic rule. It's a basic procedure. Anything above 8, we shouldn't have it. We have demoted 2 of the employees. One of the employees actually returned back, actually left the rail department, and we had another individual that received, you know, some time off on this. It's something that we're also strengthening. We're rotating some supervisors and stuff at our stations and at our yards. We used to have a lot more management at the yards, but over the years there were some cuts and some reductions and such. So it's not the excuse, because there's layers of protection and stuff there, and they're just the basic procedures. So we are rotating some management throughout these yards to make sure that we strengthen this as much as possible.
Question. The individuals involved, do you have any information on how many hours they had been working at the time with this?
Their work record, one of the individuals that left us did not have a stellar record. And the other thing, whenever they naturally do screening, drug test, everybody was clean.
But my question, though, was at the time that this took place, had they been in the middle of a 16-hour work period at that point?
No.
Okay.
No.
This was in the morning. They should have been.
After kind of the afternoon.
Just a question on that. And I know you're if a 10-car train gets into the system, the head car is going to stop at the end of the platform. The other two will be outside the station.
Outside the station
shouldn't
limits.
Be possible for anybody to get on them, but you never know.
Well, I must clarify that if somebody was to choose to walk through a bulkhead door, then they probably could get, you know, into the next rail car. But as far as servicing from a platform environment,
you could get a seat, right?
Yeah, you'd have plenty of legroom on that right there.
This was December 2nd of last year. Wasn't there another recent incident with a 10-car train that happened, like, recently?
Yes, we did have. Well, we did have one that happened, I think, the 13th, and that one was the same approach, but I will explain this one. That was at Largo. Largo is an incline, so what happened on that was that basically any time that they pull a rail car out, the rail cars automatically have a little bit of slide back, and then it takes off. They coupled up. Whenever the operator went out, the car rolled back, train lined with the other consist and brought it out. We caught that within a couple of stations, and we went through the same thing. The interlocking individual and the operator were disciplined on this. One of the things also is kind of a change in philosophy. It used to be a single point, and now we've kind of changed our approach. I've told people that a lot of these failures or incidents are never single point. There's generally a layer of reasons, or there's a layer of protection that is there to prevent these things from taking place. So in working with safety and the way that we're starting to review these things, it's not any longer just a single point. We're involving everybody that's involved in this process, and it's starting to get some people's attention.
I understand the rationale. I guess my concern is that I can understand that, you know, if this happens one time, it's an error, a human error. But if it happens twice, and I understand that they were different places, but after it happened the first time, there should have been some heightened scrutiny of the length of rail cars at the other locations. And that doesn't seem to have been the case.
It was definitely communicated in the seriousness of this. Unfortunately, you know, it did happen again.
Other questions on 10-car trains?
The next incidents deal with the rail friction rings, actually, two different incidents, and also Mr. Kubitschek will provide an update on that. And actually, this slide, then there's the bus, but actually we're going to combine the two together. So, thanks, sir.
Okay. This design here was on a 5000 series rail car. One thing to clarify, the 2s, 3s, and 4s series rail cars versus the 5000 series rail cars are different manufacturers, and these were different failure types. Actually, they're different components within the braking system, but they were related with the braking system. What we have is basically the failure occurred while we were in revenue service, and the hub actually broke, and then the friction ring fell down into the right-of-way. What we have done to this date and time is, looking at the 5000 series and all of our history of information and stuff, we identified this part as part of a certain batching or group. Whenever they produce these things, they produce them in sets. So that was our first approach, was to go after any of the 192 rail cars. Everything was cycled to say, we had a failure of this component. Let's go ahead and let's change this thing out. So those have been changed out. Along the way, we're looking at different revisions because these cars are, you know, date back into the 90s and the 2000s. So over the years, there's different revisions or different products that come out. To date, what we have done is we've expanded our review because we did not, and this is also working with safety, you know, tri-state oversight, the original equipment manufacturer also has been on site. We found another batch of hubs that we were not satisfied with the level of information and stuff that we were getting, so we chose to change those out as well. To date, we've changed out over 680 pieces of product on the fleet, and we have identified probably another 200 that we will complete.
We have gotten in an initial study, a report from the independent lab. That was the other thing that we did, is that we did not permit the original equipment manufacturer to take the materials and send it to their lab. We took the materials, and they're aware of the lab that we sent it to. And what they have come back, at least the initial reports, is that the component failed due to fatigue. At this stage, it does not appear that there was an installation issue by a person, and it does not appear to be a manufacturing issue at this time, but the product did fail due to fatigue. We expect to have the...
What, was this inside the time when it should not have failed? No, the fatigue is how many hours can it really operate without a problem?
Well, that's part of our ongoing review, because we are going back. My history to date, not here, is typically this part that we have, it lasts pretty much the life of the truck, or you use it, you know, forever. But we are going through the review of the documents to see if this has a specific service life and everything else, because there has been modifications and different revisions, you know, of these things. And so one of the things that the report did come back is what we did is that not only did we take the part that failed, but we also took some other components of other components of other batches to have them analyzed as well. And there are some different materials that are being used based off of what this lab and stuff is bringing back to us. So this is going to open up further dialogue and communications with the original equipment manufacturer and stuff across the board. So we were not only concerned about what actually, you know, where we had the defect or the failure there, but it's across the board.
Hey, Dave, these 5,000 car series cars, does this, a couple questions, does this happen on the other series cars at all?
Over the history, the twos, threes, and fours, I was told they had a crack, and I'll cover it in my other report. The 1,000 series, from what we've seen and what I've been told, they haven't had an issue there. Mm-hmm. The 6,000 series rail car, it was kind of like the next generation, and it hasn't had any failure, and it's got, you know, more advanced materials and products and stuff on it.
Follow on, the 5,000 series, these are the rail cars that were made in Spain, right?
Yes, sir.
I mean, this goes back, you know, almost to when we got them. Right? It's like our lemon cars, I call them. You know?
I mean, they have been a very challenging fleet from day one.
Yeah. Is the manufacturer still in business in Spain?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, what's their responsibility for correcting all of the, going back since we took control of these cars? I mean, they've been helpful, or are they just on the sideline?
They have moved on, and we're working more so with the brake manufacturer. Because it's really their equipment. I will say that as I get, we are going to be doing some other measurement and analysis on that there. So I guess I'll go ahead and I'll jump forward.
Well, no, I had one more question. So,
okay.
So we're going to replace the 1,000 cars when we get the new Japanese cars. So,
yeah.
What's the long-term strategy to get rid of the lemon cars?
This is a strategy here. The 7,000 series, brand new, coming in here, into the spec, we wrote in specific requirements for the manufacturer and all of the OEMs that we actually conducted tests on our infrastructure to measure our ride quality, how much force that's being applied out there. It was never really done at this level here. Everybody just kind of followed like a benchmark standard. But what we did is that we said, no, you've got to measure what this system is subjecting your equipment to. And so what's taken place is that we're actually taking the 7,000 series benchmark data that we're building stuff to. Because, for example, going across the rail or like a switch point, instantaneous measurements where, like, the impact is very sudden, there's forces being applied of over 40 G in milliseconds. You know, so if you think about when you hear about aircraft and everything else that they're talking about impacts of or what people are subjected to is 5G or 6G, we're seeing that type of stuff. And that's common, you know, within the railroad industry and stuff. But we really need to measure it to understand what's taking place. And then you're looking at the duty cycle of what we're running rail cars now and the number of rail cars and the consists. So we're taking this to a very high level, very sensitive. Now, the original equipment manufacturer of the braking system on the 5s and the 6 is a worldwide firm. They do make good products and everything else. And what we're looking at is can we take the, what we're applying on the 7,000 series and apply it onto the 5 and the 6,000 series if we needed to? Because we want to have interchangeability, economy of scale, and a much more proven design and stuff that we could apply.
Basically, just final point. So after we get the 7,000, we do all the testing. We're going to go back and retrofit the lemon cars with the new trucks or whatever you call them?
Well, with this new equipment and gear and subcomponent stuff, we will not wait that long.
Okay.
We will
is
not
that budgeted, Dave? I mean, do we have this in the capital budget too?
Not in the capital budget. We will see probably some impact on our operating budget at this stage. The original equipment manufacturer, I had discussions with them. They're actually giving us a lot of materials. That's part of the negotiation side. So we're providing the labor, but they're picking up all of the parts on their dime.
Good.
Okay.
I'm a firm believer in transparency. Who is the brake manufacturer?
Knorr.
Okay. Just as long as it's on the record.
Yes, sir. Okay. So that concludes the 5,000 series. If I could jump forward into the 2s, 3s, and 4s. That is a WABCO or WABTEC now product. What we have here, this design is basically, it's a bolt-on, straight bolt-on design. And it basically, it's a kind of like a consumable type of approach. You use the friction ring, then you unbolt the whole assembly, and then you discard it, and you throw it into the trash. And then you just install a brand new one. There's no rehab or anything else. This unit, the way it's set up is that its mounting and such takes care of all of the weight and stress, but it's exposed to a lot of heat. So there's different tolerances for bolts and different tolerances for measurements and everything else. We've been in contact with WABTEC over this product, and there were some concerns on our part. When I got here a few years ago, we started testing alternate sources. And what we've been using is the original equipment manufacturer because that's what came with the rail car. But we started testing some other products and stuff and did different vendors because we did get the answer, but we weren't 100%, you know, satisfied with that. Now, these materials that have failed and some other samples, new stuff, existing stuff, we've sent that out to a lab as well, independent. We did the same thing with them that what we did with Knorr. We expect to have a report or start getting data and stuff back to us in the middle of February. What we have done based off of this failure type is we've basically taken a no tolerance on this, on certain wear components and everything else. We have started replacing just everything in kind. To date, we've replaced between the 2s, 3s, and 4,000 series fleets, we've replaced 570 disc assemblies, and we like about 50 more. And as we cycle these things through the preventative maintenance efforts, basically if they come in and we find this defect, they're changed immediately, either that or we ground the rail car at this time.
In the past, how frequent has been the occurrence of this catastrophic failure? Losing the friction on either kind of car, losing the friction ring.
Looking at the historical information here for the Knorr braking, this hub assembly, they did have a failure, or two failures in 2006. I'm not sure, we haven't seen the magnitude and stuff of it, but it did notice that the hub, there was a hub defect there. On the WABTEC one, it looks like there's been communications about cracks and about how this thing wears over its life and deteriorates.
On the road failures.
We haven't seen anything like that.
I've never heard of that happening. But
yeah. Yeah, yeah. So we're continuing to look, into the record and everything else. There was significant cracking or whatever, and that's what prompted to get tolerances and stuff, you know, from them, what was acceptable, what was not. But now, since that has proven unreliable at this stage, we've just got to take a zero tolerance on that until we get an idea. And I would also say the other thing is, with us testing this other product, we've been testing it for the last 2 years. That's the other thing. It takes a long time, but we do have this other vendor is qualified, and they are running on our fleet and stuff, and we're seeing some great performance out of that as well.
Mr. Downey?
Yeah.
I really appreciate all this information, Mr. Kubitschek, and I want to – there's a piece of what happens when we have these failures for our passengers that I want to focus on for just a minute, because – depending on where an incident occurs, that means we have to shut the railroad down and we have to have a lot of people get off the car and all that sort of stuff. We now are in this area of emergency planning of, you know, what do we do when a train has to stop and we got people. So really my question is more for Mr. Doherty. When, you know, we've had a couple incidences over the last several months where that's been the result. When you think about the corrective action plans, do those incidents roll into that matrix in terms of how we deal with customers and how we think about that, or is that in another place? Because my concern really is this issue of emergency evacuation and or having to shut down more than just a place in the system, but work around a place in the system because we've got an incident happening.
At this point in time, actually what works into the corrective action plan is the hazard itself. If there's a hazard related to that incident, then that, you know, would end up as a potential corrective action. And that's from, you know, the most recent incidents, depending on the accident report, we look at the accident or the incident, what occurred, work on determining the root cause, establishing the facts around that particular incident, and then develop the corrective actions accordingly. And the corrective action may, you know, should hopefully affect the customer or the employee in either case. Now, sometimes it's not going to affect the time, if you're looking at that, you know, because we have to deal with the emergency, conduct the investigation, ensure safety at all times, and I know that from the corrective action perspective, you know, that's the way we're looking at it in dealing with that. But we do try to minimize the impact to the customer, certainly.
Of course, and I'm not asking this to be pedantic, but to focus the board's attention on you're doing exactly what you need to do relative to the specifics of the incident, to pinpoint it, to figure out how to fix it in the future, et cetera, et cetera. But we've had enough of these incidents that cause us to have to look at how the system runs and how the customers get out of or get around a thing. And and maybe Mr. Sarles, you're the best person to answer this. Where does that reside, that whole issue of emergency evacuation, unplanned stuff that that can come, and maybe we can have it come back to the board later, but this is just, for me, this is a pressing question because we've had four or five of these in the last 5 months that really made me wonder how we're approaching this. Yeah.
And we have had some feedback in the form of a memo, but I think some discussion this morning, but also put it on the agenda for the next time the chief is.
And we'll defer to the next time, but let me just briefly respond to that. Putting aside incident involving injury or, you know, somebody placing themselves on the track, putting aside that, so the police and the fire department are not involved. When those incidents occur, they're in charge. Today's incident, red line, when the brake part fell off, is run by the operations department under Dave Kubitschek. And the way it operates is that as soon as the incident occurs, the Rail Operations Control Center begins to issue orders as to the movement of trains, getting police out, getting operations people out, and setting up a reaction to the particular situation, including rerouting trains, short tripping trains. And depending on when Depending on when it occurs during the day, it can be a fairly even, you know, good response where we can get people out if it occurs during the off-peak hour because you don't have this rush of people. And we had an incident a few weeks ago where that occurred during the middle of the day, and everybody got into it. And by the time rush hour, and we knew it was going to go through rush hour, we had everybody in place and could handle it pretty well. If it occurs right in the middle of rush hour, that's a problem because you got people already in the system and you have to react, and it takes time to react. Example was this morning where we had a cracked rail on the red line. It occurred just before rush hour started. And what occurred is the rail operations center takes charge, starts looking at what's going on, and begins to give the directions. The maintenance people get to their work train, get prepared to pull it out of the yard, and then work with the operations control center to get to the site. In the meantime, I layered over that, which has been a more recent introduction. Dave's judgment and call, he sets up a conference line of the executive staff who are not running the operation moment to moment. That's the people that are out in the field and are just above them actually running the operation. But we get a conference call together and we discuss if there are issues arising, how to respond to it more strategically if necessary. So that's quickly the way that, but the responsibility for the operation reacting to it, if it's a rail emergency, is Dave Kubicek. If it's primarily a bus, it's Jack Requa.
Thank you. That's actually really, really helpful. I do appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, just to piggyback on what Mary said, when we have that further discussion, one other element I'd like to put in there is pretty simple, and that is, what do we tell the people on the train? Because I cannot tell you how many times I've been on a train, and it'll stop and this, and you don't have any notice at all as to what's going on or how long you're going to be. I realize you can't tell them how long, but at least some communication with the customer, the passenger, so that they know that what's going on.
Be glad to review that with you and how we set that up and what is done and what improvements we've made to that.
Okay, so we'll put this on the agenda for the next time the chief is there, but as you say, it's more from the point of view of the customer and
right.
What do they know. I'll just note, when Rich and I worked together years ago, one of my jobs was once a week I had to go to the control center and sit through the rush hour in the evening to be the voice for the customer.
Well, and the last thing I would say when you come back to us, Mr. Sarles, is I have been made aware of the fact that Metro and the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission did emergency planning around each of our stations. Needs to be updated, I suspect. I don't know if that's true in the other jurisdictions, but I know from Arlington's perspective, we actually spend a lot of time talking with our citizens about that. So if there are major messages, given the high number of riders we have, that we can help to educate customers about these things and to fine-tune our work together, you know, we stand ready to do that. We really want to make sure we're pushing messages out. The thing I've learned about emergency preparedness since 9/11 is it's a constant conversation, and the more this just becomes how we think about our ride, the better off we are.
And I didn't get into
tabletop exercises.
Exactly.
And what I did not get into, and we certainly get into next time because I excluded all the things with the emergency services, is the high level of cooperation there is, including when an incident is concluded, the respective fire department coming in and going through a hot wash with us so we can get lessons learned.
Okay. And the other incident was the
bus incident on December 28th. I'll ask Mr. Requa to provide an update.
Yeah. On December 28th, bus number 6206 was proceeding northbound on Rockville Pike. Coming southbound was a Toyota pickup in the curb lane, and it crossed over the second lane, it crossed over the third lane, it jumped the median and ran head-on into the bus. As a result of the collision, the bus veered to the right, went over the curb lane, went over the curb, and ended up in front of a tree. The operator of the pickup, I'm not sure if he was dead on at the scene, but it was a fatality for the operator of the pickup. Our bus operator had to be cut out of the bus. We had three passengers that refused aid. Six passengers were transported. The operator was transported. And I'm pleased to report, after looking at some of the pictures, to believe that the operator, fortunately, had broken toes on both feet, broken ring finger, some other cuts and bruises, but essentially, considering the impact of the vehicle and the tree, I think that we're pretty fortunate.
So she's recovering?
Pardon me? Yes, she's recovering. Yes, she's certainly not back to work, but she's going through therapy and has pins in her toes, pins in her fingers, things like that. So very unfortunate incident, a non-preventable accident from our standpoint, and I think according to the chief, I think, you know, there probably is an autopsy taking place as to the reason for the operator of the truck coming across the
And as
truck.
I recall from the coverage on that, we had good drive cam.
We did.
Mm-hmm. Coverage, yeah, we had, showing exactly what yeah, happened.
Saw the whole thing.
Thank you. Any other business for the Safety and Security Committee? Yes.
Yeah, on page 32, you talk about injury rates per 200,000 hours in the various operations groups. And I just see some areas as far as injury rates are certainly well above 5%, which I think is a good goal. And I'm kind of curious in how we're trying to address some of those groups, operations groups, and reducing the not only the number of injuries but also the injury rate. And certainly whether there's some incentive program in for the groups and whether there's some friendly competitions in the groups, or in fact, you know, which group has got the greatest decrease rate in a month or 2 months or quarterly. Are those kinds of things being considered to bring down some of these injury rates in those four areas that seem to be well above 5%?
Yes, sir. Actually, one of the programs we have that as a team, in the units, they have to work as a team. If they work 90 days without a lost time injury, there's actually a recognition in which they receive a $25 grocery coupon, if you will, from an area store. If they go 6 months, it's $50, 9 months, $75, all year, $100, and then it starts over again. Then we also have, you know, as you know, we recognize employees at our annual Champions of Safety Awards ceremony where we have that recognition. We're looking more now to actually build in some competition now that we have some data to use. We're looking at another program similar to the police MetroStat that we're going to look at as SafeStat for actually where we target and focus a group to actually get the best, hopefully, achievements. So we're actually looking more into a competition, but we want the competition to be within it, within our own groupings, to most improve. So that's one of the things that we're looking at there. And yes, as noted earlier, the slips, trips, and falls. That's almost 60% of our injuries in the agency. So that's why we built a training program that just started in January for employees. We discussed it at executive safety on Tuesday, and the operations folks were working with making sure that employees attend that program so that they're aware, just in case they're not aware how to lift, but also provide a reminder for the safety awareness. So a lot of things from a lot of different angles to try and, you know, achieve the greatest reduction.
Yes, I think Mr. Dyke was.
Yeah, just a brief question. Are we going to discuss the fatigue
yes.
rules? And
yeah, we're okay. going to come back to that.
I noticed that suicides are up. I have a Golden Gate Bridge suggestion. They don't report them. I don't know how we're handling these suicides, but when people jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, it doesn't get reported.
Fortunately, it doesn't stop traffic on the bridge, which is why
I understand that. But I think we need to talk about how we handle these suicides, which I think are related to a number of factors, most notably maybe the economy, I don't know. But they seem to happen quite more often than not, and people might be better off not knowing about them.
Could I make a different question out of that? There have been some coverage in the press about the recommendations about suicide prevention, and
it would be good, but perhaps not for this meeting, but for next meeting, about a status review and update for the safety committee on the implementation of the recommendations about suicides.
Could you go back to the slide that had fatigue rules on it? I'd like to comment on that. Mr. Dyke's request, and it's a good one, was what has been happening outside of Metro with respect to fatigue. There have been, in the last year, and two of them within the last 2 months, federal actions to deal with fatigue in different transportation modes. And this is a compilation of what has been done based on scientific research in terms of employee capabilities and the like, but it is a subject that has been worked on a lot, and there are both similarities and differences that are worth looking at. In each of these modes, aviation, FMCA, SCSA is truck drivers, federal rail, and then what APTA has been doing on a voluntary basis. The trend is control the number of hours during the day that the employee can be on the job, provide a minimum rest period so that when they go home, they have enough time to sleep, enough time to recover. Preferably have a management system in place to deal with fatigue. Limit the number of hours that can be worked within a week, so there's some control there. And generally provide at least one period during the week where there's a long time opportunity to recover. So, so many hours a day, so many hours for sleeping. There's a preference in most of these rules to put some of those sleeping hours in the nighttime, because our bodies actually function better in sleep mode when it's dark. Limit the number of hours during the week and basically give one day off, which may be a tenet of our religions, but also has a physiological basis to it, that if you've accumulated a little sleep debt during the week, you can repay it if you have one day off. If you don't have a day off, you're just going to continue to degrade. So each of these top three lines has been issued as a federal requirement. There is no opportunity, because the law doesn't exist, for either federal or state agencies to put a requirement on us. But our discussion over the last several months is we've got to have a standard that meets the basis of the science. The other point about these is they are not identical. What makes sense in the aviation world is specific to aviation. Pilots fly across time zones. You've got to deal not only with days and nights, but jet lag. Truck drivers are out there basically on the road by themselves, and their work pattern includes both driving and unloading, or standing by while somebody else unloads. That's why they can have a longer day, but a limit as to how many hours they are behind the wheel. And the fact is, even within that behind the wheel time, with a lengthy debate, the Department of Transportation would have preferred to make that 10 hours. They could not get the cost-benefit analysis to pencil out at 10. They had to settle for 11. But there's also a requirement that when you hit 8, you must then have a 30-minute break so that you're not 11 consecutive hours. Federal Rail has to deal with the fact that railway crews oftentimes start their day one place, end their day in another place, and that has to be built in. So each industry has to adopt a standard that makes sense for their type of business, just as we will have to, but there are physical and physiological issues here that just say you can only ask so much before you put your employees and your customers at safety risk.
I think you've said that very well, and the only point, additional point I would make is that what's common amongst these various approaches is that the safety for the employees and the safety for the passengers should be the only factors that Absolutely. Are considered as we make decisions about fatigue and about rules and management and how many hours people work, and anything else, quite honestly, is irrelevant, and we need to be driving it with those two points. And I think it's the more we hear about that, the better as we go forward.
Where we have the regulated industry, that is a federal requirement to do that. I suspect that the truck driver rule will be brought to court. It's been issued three times in the last 11 years and has been brought to court each time, but I saw a report yesterday that Congressman Issa held a hearing on this. He said, well, you know, it doesn't look too bad, so maybe this time it will stand up. But it's not a choice. It's not a trade-off. It's not, we can't do this because it's not economic. There are limits that just have to be respected if we're going to have safety for the employees, for the customers, and for the general public.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I have a feeling about this that is pretty strong about the authority's responsibility to set its own limits about overtime. As I understand it, overtime limits are not part of the collective bargaining agreements now. We have 1 week arbitration that the authority didn't do a very good job about preparation for because there was no real backup about this kind of data and analysis. I believe it is imperative for this board to not wait for APTA, which may take years,
or the federal government
to take decades to do this. And I can't speak to what other authorities around the country are doing. They have to do this like we do. They have to do it themselves about protecting their employees and their passengers. I would say, for instance, APTA's proposed standards of 14 hours with 10 hours off with no weekly or monthly cap means that you could work 98 hours a week, which doesn't fit with any realm of acceptable safety margins for the employees or the customers. I believe it's imperative for the staff to make a recommendation to the board about what we believe is a safe set of standards for our employees about overtime, and that the board has a responsibility for making a final policy decision in public to establish what those are and let the system then work its way through, whether it is a protest from labor, which I can't imagine would be protesting rules that are intended to protect their members. But I believe this body has a affirmative responsibility to acknowledge that we have a problem about overtime without limit and that we need to set what we think are safe standards for daily and weekly overtime and debate it publicly and do it in a timely fashion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Mr. Downs, but if we proceed on this course, I also think we need to look at this issue holistically, and there are impacts to personnel in terms of numbers. There are impacts to the pace of our capital rebuilding program. Obviously, there's a budget issue attached with that, as well as service levels if we impose this on employees. So we, as a board, I think is a very, I think safety is our number one priority, but we also have to be clear with the public what those trade-offs are. So I would just suggest if the staff is going to come back at some point in time with a report that that's all bundled together so we have a clear.
I would argue that those consequences, whether it be budgets for additional people or potential slowdown of capital, those can be mitigated. The outcome of a crash, particularly if people are killed, not
I would like to clarify one thing, two things. One is the slowing down the capital program can have its own safety consequences.
Yes.
Which can be greater than what we're talking about here. So
that can be mitigated by resources.
That's exactly right. The other thing is we have embarked on a fatigue management study to provide the science, if you will. I have said before that we're not going to wait for APTA or the industry or regulation or TOC or whatever. We're going to do the fatigue management study. We have begun the steps on that. In terms of interviews, we're going to look at bus and metro access, just not rail. We're in the process, have retained one expert to help us. We're in the process of retaining a firm that has done this kind of work before in some of these industries so that we're not reinventing the wheel, if you will. And that's something that we're going to accomplish this year, right, Jim?
Correct.
Correct.
Mr. Chairman.
And it will be, therefore, evidence-based policy as opposed to policy-based evidence.
Right. Yes. Mr. Chairman. So we won't have those weak arbitration rules.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to piggyback a little bit on what Tom said about time being of the essence here. I think we need to move quickly. I think the earlier comment about this being broader than just that issue is important as well, and I want to commend my distinguished colleague from Prince George's County, who has said repeatedly that as we get into this, it's got to be a two-way street. We need to have some open dialogue with our employees and let them understand that our priority here, our fiduciary responsibility, is safety for our employees and for our passengers, and that's what's driving it, but it'll be done in a partnership way. So the sooner we can get this done, the better, quite honestly. So full speed ahead.
Well, I don't know, Tom, we talked about this earlier in the week. Do you want to put that proposal that you eloquently stated in the form of a measure, but I defer to the chairman on.
I think the board would have to have some more conversation, including conversation with the manager about the status of his studies and the recommendations that he would be making and when he would be making them. I think this is a partnership between the board and the professional staff.
As well as the working staff.
As well as the work staff.
And the talk and everybody else. But we will keep focusing on this over the course of the year and anxiously looking to an outcome. And I think we need to, as we're in collective bargaining, be clear that that's not an issue that's on the table. Any other business for the Safety Security Committee? If not, we'll adjourn the meeting and go on to the next.